We're at the Pacific Palisades home of one of the most prolific producers and directors and versatile performers even on radio and television too, I think. He's Mr. Phil Cohan. And Phil, thank you for letting us visit today.
Glad to have you. Performing was not one of my things, except prior to radio when I was a saxophone player in bands.
So many people start out as musicians. Mm-hmm. That was on the East Coast, wasn't it?
Yes. I went to the University of Pennsylvania and played in bands down there, mm-hmm. and that got me my job at Paramount Pictures in their Eastern Studio in Long Island, where there was a lot of important movies being made.
Well, what were you doing there at Paramount then?
Well, they were looking for trainees and from college students, first mm-hmm. time they ever got involved with people from higher education, I guess. Anyway, because of my musical training, they were looking for somebody to build up a music department, put in this new thing called talkie pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 1928, so I got the job at $30 a week, and I went there, and there was a musical director, and then I was sort of the manager and began to build up this department.
Well, and how were you doing that? Were you selecting music to be played with things, or sheet music, or
what? We had very, very good professional musicians. We scored a lot of pictures and
mm-hmm.
stuff,
mm-hmm.
but I was sort of the executive, would arrange the recording sessions and whatnot. And then we began to build our department. We took on people like Johnny Green,
mm-hmm.
who wrote Body and Soul while we was there, and Vernon Duke, who later wrote April in Paris, and we had Yip Harburg, the lyric writer, who later wrote Over the Rainbow and a thousand other pictures. So a wonderful group of musical talent came out, and a fellow named Benny Herman, who became Bernard Herman, who did Citizen Kane with Orson Welles, the music on that. And so it was pretty exciting. And then, of course, being near New York and Broadway, see, there were a lot of actors out here who couldn't talk when it came to talking
uh-huh.
pictures.
Out here in California.
And so mm-hmm. there you had access to Broadway, and you mm-hmm. had Claudette Colbert, and Ginger Rogers made her first movies there, and the Marx Brothers made their first mm-hmm. two movies there. That was great fun. And so you had access to the New York stage, where you had talking actors yeah. and people. So it was a very exciting period until the Depression came along, and they closed down the studio in 1932. And eventually, actually through Johnny Green, whom I gave his first job as a rehearsal pianist, he got me an interview with CBS, and eventually I wound up at CBS and sort of program development, and that was a whole wonderful period there. That was the golden years, you know.
Now, that at CBS at that time, now that was WABC in New York then, wasn't it? Or were you
WCBS, wasn't it?
Well, ABC first, then it became CBS.
No.
That was just a few caller changes.
I think ABC was the Blue Network. That was the, now, whatever it's called now, yeah.
Well, American Broadcasting.
American Broadcasting, right.
So at any rate, now, what was the scene there? Who was there at that time?
Well, there again, it was a really a wonderful period. Now, for instance, our announcing staff, we had Paul Douglas, who became mm-hmm. a great actor, Andre Baruch, Ralph Edwards, Mel Allen, who became the sports announcer for the Yankees years
yeah.
later. Danny Seymour, who used to do all the soap operas and then became president of J. Walter Thompson. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there was a great array of talent, and the reason was because CBS was only about 6 years old when I joined, 1934.
Mm-hmm.
I was just talking to, had been with a friend 2 nights ago named Lynn Murray, who became a composer out here,
mm-hmm.
and he joined CBS then. And they had all this open time, and so the way Bill Paley built the network is by furnishing shows out of New York to the hinterlands and all across the way. Meanwhile, they signed up to take whatever commercial shows came along. So you had hours of non-commercial time, and anybody with an idea that felt pretty good, you had a good chance of putting it on. So there was endless of what we call sustaining shows.
Non-commercial.
Non-commercial. I never knew. I just got a salary and did hundreds of shows, really. And things like experimental show with Rodgers and Hart. We did an original musical comedy. and great experience. They couldn't sell it; it was too expensive. It cost $5,000 a week,
which was a lot of money for a radio.
Well, with Rodgers and Hart, who were already huge successes on Broadway, you know. So that was an interesting time. And then you had people like Burl Ives, who was working on the WPA, the government contributed during the Depression. Would work. And a lot of talent that I can't even think about that came out. CBS was the place to go. NBC wasn't quite that interesting because it was part of RCA and it was a corporate thing. And Bill Paley was his own. This was his baby, and he loved programming. And then what's his name? Who used to run WBBM? Levy?
Atlas.
Les Atlas. Oh, yeah. I knew him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I did shows out of WBM.
Did you?
Many times. Yeah. Mm-hmm. With the Jimmy Durante, Gary Moore, and then I had in 1936, I was started a jazz show called the Saturday Night Swing Club. It was on for about 3 years, at 7 o'clock Saturday night. Can you imagine Saturday night sustaining at 7 to 7:30? Never thought about selling it.
Yeah. And you were to build programming. You weren't interested.
Well, I created that, but then I became a director as well. Uh-huh. And, you know, I was a producer-director primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And did a lot of shows, other people's creations, but I did those things.
It was a busy time for CBS, for you, and for radio. I
mean, yeah, those were literally the golden years. Yeah. On top of that, you had the commercial programs. You had people like Jack Benny. And I was out here when Bob Hope started his first show, and Jerry Colonna was on it. Jerry used to play trombone in the CBS band back in CBS. And then out of that came a group called the Ray Scott Quintet. You know where you were then? Ray Scott Quintet.
Sure.
Yeah. Had lunch with them about 4 weeks ago. So a lot of interesting that we weren't aware of, like anything else. You're not aware of it yourself, you know. You were young and go, work all kinds of hours and never kept records of a lot of these things. Do a script, or give it to my secretary, and she'd file it away. Yeah. I don't have scripts of a lot of those things.
Probably not too many copies of the broadcast either.
No.
Most everything was live at that time. Almost virtually everything was live, wasn't it?
Oh, it was all live. This was long before tape.
Yeah.
But they used to take those big 16-inchers, and it was in the CBS library. You know, they take it off the air. You did have it because if you wanted to run it next week and find out what you did last week. So that was all available, but you didn't take that home.
Yeah, and you never recorded anything to broadcast. You didn't record this and then play the record on
there. No,
you just recorded it for reference.
This was live. The biggest event for a lot of the what they call production men who were assigned to be with you to see that you got off the air at 29:30 because that was the time the network switched and you went to the local. So their big idea of a great show was say, hey. Boy, on the nose we got off. Could have been a terrible show, but
as long as it got off on time.
A lot of these secondary guys, hey, that was their job to get you on and off. It was an amusing time,
A director would have the responsibility for seeing that the show was performed properly. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
A producer would be responsible for, go ahead.
Well, let me point out something. In those days, it was... You were a producer-director in radio. It wasn't like television.
Mm-hmm.
So if you produce it, you directed it. When I first went there, I didn't know, you know, about timing and all this, and I was sort of a program developer, and there were a few things that I was involved in getting on the air, like a peace program, a world peace-wise thing, and I let somebody else put it on, but I was supervising it. But eventually, you produced and directed. And so, like, when I went on the road with the Paul Whiteman Chesterfield show all over the country, you had to direct and produce wherever you came from, live. That's another story when you went traveling.
Well, tell us about it.
Well, I was involved in a show for Chesterfield Cigarettes. Paul Whiteman, you know who he was?
Of course.
Great guy in Chicago.
You spent a lot of time on WBBM in Chicago.
That's right. And anyway, I was producer, but when on the road, I had a director, too. So he'd go down. We did the colleges. They were in Duke University, and he'd broadcast from a gym. And the sound is terrible. It's bouncy all over. I had a bunch of students go out and get a lot of rugs and put down to absorb some of the sound. And then you're working from remote. You had to work with the telephone company to see if they got the lines in from wherever they got got them in and on time. And so it was a pretty hectic thing. So that was my job. And when you went on remotes, they call them, you had to arrange all this stuff.
Were you working with your own engineers, your own CBS engineers, or were you working with the local guys?
Both. They would very often send down a top guy, or one of the men from New York who'd been on the show. But that got to be kind of expensive. So then you had to set up in advance to do it, so that you had to rehearse these fellas locally to put on the show. Sometimes it could be a disaster. When I was doing a show with Jimmy Durante from Dallas, Texas, we didn't know, but the engineer was, he was on something, and he fouled up the whole thing for about 5 minutes. So, it was good, but you had to be young and be able to...
And that was your job to make sure that they were doing it right.
Oh, sure, and I had to throw the cues, on and off, and my script girl had to tell me how we were doing on timing. This is all live, and it was pretty tricky. Then you have to figure, supposing it's running over, what do you do? But you had to make all kinds of cuts, run out there and cut the next page and do that, and so that you got off in time.
In a program where it's mostly script work, where they're reading from the script, and you're behind the glass, so to speak, and you're watching the timing, and all of a sudden you say, gee, we're going to have to cut 30 seconds or whatever, and you go page ahead and decide to cut this out. How do you get the word to the performers who are doing it live out there?
Well, sometimes you just walk out with it. You have a cut. And usually, if you were a good producer, director, which I think I was pretty good, you anticipated a lot of those things. You had it marked in your script. You know, cut one or cut two or something, if necessary. Then there were times when you came up short, you had time to fill at the end. And, you know, you could hear the orchestra playing Rhapsody in Blue endlessly or something like that. You'd have an announcement ready to say, and like, you know, next week we are going to have so-and-so and so-and-so and so-on.
So that's why at the end of some programs, when they tell you what's coming on for the next 6 weeks in advance,
very often,
you knew that they were short.
Very often.
And they were filling.
I was lucky. I never had any of those big lapses. I've heard shows where they went on for 5-8 minutes. Nothing was happening. They didn't know what. You heard the music playing over and over and over again. And I always used to anticipate problems and be ready for them. So I had some problems, but not many.
Well, that's a sign, I think, of a good producer director, to anticipate an accident before it happens. Yeah. So you were on the road, and how did you get out to California?
Well,
to work.
Well, I came out. This was before they did the Whiteman show. He took over a show from Alice Faye, Hal Kemp. Well, I don't have to go into that. I was out here for 4 months, and then they bought Paul Whiteman, and when he went back to New York, I became the producer, director. But what took me out permanently is back in New York, I was doing a show called The Camel Comedy Caravan for the William Esty Agency. And that was a big hour variety show. We picked up people from the coast and had all the stars on in New York. And we had Jimmy Durante and Gary Moore on one time, not as a team. They didn't even know each other. Gary was due to have his own show at NBC, a morning show like he had in Chicago. Gary was very big in Chicago in those years. I didn't even know him then. And through a set of circumstances, we had to get a show together. We put together Jimmy Durante and Gary Moore in about 10 days. And we went on the air in New York, and then Durante had a new movie contract with MGM. And we came out here, 1943, for a while, and we came back here permanently in 1944. And Gary decided to move his family, and I did, and everybody, we all moved out en masse with a private car and on the train.
Were you still with CBS at this time?
No. CBS, I left CBS in 1941 to freelance. I did a thing called the Coca-Cola Spotlight Bands. I did a lot of those from Chicago. God, I remember staying at the Drake and holding onto that rope outside in a cold, windy day. They still have that?
I don't think the rope is still there. You mean along the beach?
Along Michigan Avenue there, when the winds were up, they had a rope right there.
So that people from California wouldn't blow away.
Well, I don't know about people from California, but they had it there. That's one of my memories of Chicago. Anyway, we came to California, and I was with Durante for, 1943 to 1950, and then by that time Gary Moore had left 1948 to start his own show, morning show, and then it went on to where he had that great evening show with Carol Burnett and all that. And I stayed with Durante, and then I went east for 2 years when he went to do his first television show. And of course, during a period, I say Jimmy Durante and Gary Moore, but we had a variety of shows. We had Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra.
On the Comedy Island. Caravan.
No, this was on the Jimmy Durante, Gary Moore show.
All of these people as guests.
Yeah, the Comedy Caravan, I happened to be doing it at a time when Durante and Moore at what different times were on. And then I helped put them together to form a show of their own for Camel.
Yes. What did you see in these two really different type of comedians that you thought could make them work well together?
Well, it's like everything else, it's accidental. I was a great fan of Durante's, and he made his first movie at Paramount when I was there, I think called Roadhouse Nights, a real turkey. But that was Clayton Jackson Durante. That was his great comedy trio that they did nightclubs with. And I love this craziness. And so I had booked him on this Camel Comedy Cab just for a spot. And Gary Moore, through the agency, I heard some of his records from Chicago. And I wanted him to come on. And he emceed the show one night. And we had a singer named Lanny Ross, who I just read died about 4 weeks ago.
Not
did you ever hear of him?
Yes.
He was a big thing and a hell of a nice guy. I always heard it was embarrassing, but he was not a guy to hold a comedy show together, comedy and music. And Gary came on one night, and gee, I said, oh, that's great. And Lanny was off that week, so eventually I persuaded the agency to take on. And then through Jimmy Durante, they were on same show one time, but different spots. They didn't even know each other. But it just sounded good. The young, fresh guy and Durante, the guy from the Lower East Side, and this wonderful, natural, native kind of humor that he had.
Was this about the time, I think Abbott and Costello were on for Camel Cigarettes at this time, weren't they?
Well, that's how we got on. Costello came down with, I think, rheumatic fever. They needed a show. And we put this together in 10 days and went on the air, sort of a substitute.
And was it going to be just temporary? Or?
Yeah. And, I can't even remember all the things involved there. But eventually they kept the Jimmy Durante, Gary Moore show for Campbell. And then we came out here, and as I say, we had all the Hollywood people on, Garson and Boyer and Lucille Ball, everybody.
A rich treasure trove of talent out here on the West Coast because of the movies.
And everybody loved Durante, you know.
I know they did, yes.
You can't go wrong. As I used to say, don't ever sue Durante. He got in the court. What actually happened? A great writer named Jack Douglas.
Yes.
A very funny guy, and I hired him as my top writer. And Jack was a wonderful, funny guy, but he had whims. Anyway, am I digressing, or do you want to hear
this? You're right on target.
Jack was a wonderful writer and a great guy, and he got very hurt one time. We turned down, when we were in rehearsal with know, Ray Singer wasn't working for us there. We turned down a skit, and we wanted him to rewrite it. He refused to. And he stalked out of the room. Well, you know, we were going on in 2 days. We needed a spot, so I had to pay our other writers $500 or $600 to write another sketch to fit in. Anyway, he was working for MTA, and then he wanted to come back on the show, and we said no, because, you know, you don't do that. Broke his contract. So Jack sued us. And I ran into him. I said, Jack, don't do that. I mean, you know, you're too big a guy and all that. You were wrong. So anyway, he sued us. Well, Durante got on the stand, and I'm telling you. And he says to the judge, he says, we're paying this man $1,250 a week, and I can't find a funny thing that he's ever written for me. Well, this is devastating, which is not true. But anyway, here's the judge probably getting $250 a week himself. Yeah. You know, these things hurt. But anyway, then Durante was once sued by someone in connection with a swimming pool. He didn't pay. There was a lien on it or something like that. And I heard about that. So I always said, don't ever sue Durante, because he gets in, he gets them all laughing, and they all feel sorry for the little guy here. You know, what are you doing with this little fella? And Jimmy works on that. So he was a beautiful guy, Durante.
Everybody liked him. And was it natural? Was it natural, all these malaprops and the mangling of the English language?
Well, it started off natural, and a lot of it was. Mm-hmm. But naturally, writers, you arrange for it to put these things in because you know it's going to sound natural. Mm-hmm. So Jimmy was a smart showman. He knew them. But a lot of it, if he was sitting here, you'd eventually hear a malaprop or something like that, you know.
Well, from the Camel Caravan, where Jimmy and Gary Moore were teamed together, then eventually Gary left that show, and Jimmy went on for Rexall, I guess, didn't he?
Well, yes. It wasn't exactly the Caravan. I shouldn't have even watched that. That was a show that was on, and I was brought in to take it over. They were having problems. And on that show, Jimmy and Gary made their first appearance.
Yes.
Then we went on and formed a separate show, Jimmy Durante, Gary Moore Show.
This was the Durante Moore Show.
For Camel.
For
Camel. And we came to the coast, and then eventually Camel dropped it. It was during the war. Mm-hmm. Ran out of cigarettes or something. And, which a lot of people will be glad to hear now.
Yes.
But they, and then Rexall. We were on for Rexall for 3 years, I guess. And after Gary Moore left the show, I had Don Ameche come on, and Alan Young came on. Then we had Arthur Treacher is one of our gals, and Florence Halep was a mainstay.
She was Hot Breath Houlihan.
Hot Breath Houlihan, yeah. And Florence is great. So she was, and we had a great bench of wonderful talent out here. Actors and actresses could come in and do anything. Well, we had that back in New York, too.
Well, were you the person responsible for getting all the talent on this show, getting all these people together?
Well, basically, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the writers might have an idea that somebody like that might be good, but I would have to call their agent or whatever it was and make the, you know.
Well, how did you hit on, for example, what made you decide on Arthur Treacher for that series?
Well, I can tell you, Jimmy had something to do with that, because back in the movies, Jimmy had a radio show on very early in the, out here, I think in the 30s, and the Treacher played a butler or something like that, you know. So after Gary left, which was, for me, I was very concerned about who I was going to have take Gary's place. Mm-hmm. Gary wanted to leave and go on his own, which was the right thing for him to do. And Jimmy understood that. So getting somebody to replace Gary, not to be like another Gary, but to fill the spot. So we got Arthur Treacher, but Jimmy brought it up. And Arthur was fine. He was great for a while. Don Ameche, I think Alan Young, Mm-hmm. Came on really. I think he was the first one after Gary, but I'd used him once in New York, and so we got Alan Young on to replace Gary, and then eventually Don Ameche. It was good because he's a good actor, and he could sing, he could do anything.
It all worked. It all worked together. You had Peggy Lee.
Then I got Peggy Lee. Yeah. Funny thing, I've got to bring a picture of her over to somebody I played golf with yesterday. Yeah, Peggy Lee was on for a year. It was really her first. She'd been on some radio, but I think it was her first important appearance.
As a kid, listening to the radio, I think I was probably first exposed to Jimmy Durante with Gary Moore, and I always thought that they were and had been and always would be a team,
yeah,
like Abbott and Costello or Olson and Johnson or whatever. Yeah. And I had not realized that Jimmy, of course, had this fantastic career before that, and Gary Moore, he had his career too, which was really kind of taking off at the time he joined forces with
right.
Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
And it surprised me when Gary left, and in effect it was Jimmy on his own, because it was the Durante Moore show, the nose and the haircut. That's what they.
And he was calling him Junior all the time.
Junior, yeah. And then it became the Jimmy Durante show. Of course, as I was getting a little older, I started seeing Jimmy in the movies mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. I want to talk more about Jimmy Durante and about your career in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We're visiting in the Pacific Palisades in a lovely patio setting outdoors. With the birds chirping and
that's right.
Somebody cutting a lawn down the ways and a truck passing on the side. But it's a delightful day, and we're visiting with Phil Cohan, and we'll be back in just a flash. We're talking with Phil Cohan, who was a producer and director in the best days of radio. And would you say that those were the best days of radio, Phil, when you were involved with them?
Yes, it's pretty easy to explain. As mm-hmm. I say, this was an innovative time. There was loads of opportunities if you had an idea to get it on the air, non-commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly CBS was really the hotbed of people with creative ideas. You know, Norman Corwin came.
Mm-hmm.
Norman's office was next to mine. He had a tremendous array. At that time, he didn't realize how important it was, you know, like so many things. He didn't realize it later on. But they were really the golden days. Now, they had that in television right after that, too, in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't involved that much. I went back to New York with Durante to do television and then came back out here and did some television producing. I didn't direct. But those were the really the great years, 1930s and 40s, for radio.
What?
Because it was live, primarily.
I was just going to say, what made those golden days of radio so golden? Was it because it was live?
That had a lot uh-huh. to do. There was an excitement to it. Mm-hmm. And also, people were just beginning to want to go on radio. You know, there were a lot of actors in the theater that would have nothing to do with this. And movie stars, you know, unless you have costumes, you have...
Mm-hmm.
And I was aware of that, having come from 5.5 years of a movie studio.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Radio said, you know, I said, well, this is a cinch. What is this? You know, you stand in front of a microphone and read a script. There's no cameras. There's no lighting. There's no costuming.
No makeup.
No makeup.
Yeah.
And you have to know your lines. And so it was kind of a transition period, both for me and... it just seemed like a cinch. So you had to kind of create your own. And, of course, it was great for me, and I think I was valuable to CBS because I'd come from scoring movies, you know, with big orchestras and mm-hmm. composers and sound. And I began to use a lot of that in radio and used it well because I understood scoring, how to score and cut off and come on. And so I did a lot of great shows. I did shows with Paul Robeson, all black mm-hmm. cast orchestra. And a lot of things like that no one had ever done. Did a black show with Ethel Waters and Duke Ellington.
Mm-hmm.
And all black cast. They used to call me the Great White Father. but there was this wonderful bunch of talent coming down from mm-hmm. Harlem now that was just beginning to be acknowledged into New York City, you know, like Duke Ellington.
And on the on the radio shows, that music that you're talking about, the scoring, that played a very important role in radio, because that served to try and a transition from one scene to the next.
Yeah.
And to set the tone of it. It might be up, it might be down, it might be... Well,
very much a part of radio, yeah. And the very fact that I'd had this experience and background in movies, whereas a lot of directors, you know, they did it adequately, but I think I was way ahead of a lot of people, and I had the feeling for it. And so that the musical directors, and we had a great collection of Andre Castellanos, Mark Warno, these names don't mean much to you, Freddie Rich, and very talented musical directors at CBS. Mm-hmm. I forgot to mention the music talent they had there. And they had all different kinds of orchestras. They had a chamber music group, and Mitch Miller played oboe there, and you know who Mitch Miller was?
Sure.
Well, he played oboe in the Lou Ensemble, and Benny Herman finally got to do his own little group, and
A richness of talent that was shared by the listeners.
And you were being paid for it, you see. Yeah. It was, as I say, you asked me, was this a golden era? I would have to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
Orson Welles did his things there, and a wonderful bunch of actors had come, and it was very... Norman Corwin did his first things there. Remember when Norman had his office next to me, and he went on the... I forget what his first show was. But they could try out things. It was Sunday afternoons. Mm-hmm. You could put on things like that.
And if there was no sponsor involved, there wasn't so critical then. They weren't worried about trying to please the sponsor.
Well, you had open time that you had to fill. Mm-hmm. Cool, you know, Sunday afternoon, they'd have the Philharmonic on from Carnegie Hall or something. Mm-hmm. CBS always carried that. That's sustaining, no sponsorship. Mm-hmm. Then after that, they might have the doodle 6 o'clock till something came on. And news wasn't that important either, you know.
Well, news didn't come into its own until war.
Right, and Ed Murrow and that group came on.
That's true. Ed Murrow, too, was with CBS, and what a, you know, incredible person he was.
Yeah,
he did.
Well, I remember we had a going-away party for Ed. He was in the news department, which is a very small group there, to open up our office in London. See, this was before the war.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like 1937. And he did a great job for me. I had this Saturday Night Swing Club, which became the first network jazz show. And there was a group in Paris called the Hot Club of France. Stephen Grappelli, a great guitar player. Grappelli does concerts around here. And Django Reinhardt. Mm-hmm. These names probably all sound kind of strange. And I had all their records. I still had them. And I wanted to get them on the air. So I talked to Ed in London. Oh, there was a short wave then. You didn't have any cables.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was going to go over to Paris and put them on. Now, Ed knew next to nothing about really jazz. Anyway, he arranged. We had conversations. He went over to put them on. And I have a record with his voice on and picking them up from Paris. Unfortunately, reception wasn't too good because of the weather conditions.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But Ed is on there, and I always felt kind of guilty because at the end of the show, I never gave him credit and said, you know, that was Ed Murrow. Although when he came on, he says, this is Ed Murrow and the Heart of the Monarch, 4 o'clock in the morning. Those are little interesting things that occur to me once in a while.
Did you do any work for Armed Forces Radio during the war?
Well, we would, the individuals would do that. Durante would do it. Mm-hmm. Moore would do it, so forth. But we went around to camps and did broadcasts from there. And I remember going to Chicago for the Navy and doing our show from there. And then we went down to Washington to do a show for the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which was the last appearance of Franklin Roosevelt. And it was 1945, April, and 2 weeks later we went back in Hollywood and heard that he died.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy and Gary and Danny Thomas and Danny Kaye, we all went down there to put a show on.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was not a broadcast.
No. This is an annual thing, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which was a private thing at which the president, whoever the president was, would attend. But they were surrounded by Secret Service. This was still, the war was going on.
Oh, absolutely.
On. And I was a great Roosevelt admirer. And my memory of this is they were wheeling, I never knew he was in a wheelchair until I saw him. They brought him in, and then he left, went out the freight elevator, which was backstage. And I followed it down, and Danny Kaye went over and talked to him. I didn't have the courage to talk to him. But this was a great thrill for me. And then 3 weeks later, he went to Georgia Warm Springs and died. Mm-hmm. And so this was his last public appearance, so this was kind of an eventful
thing. It was nice for you that you got to see him then.
Yeah.
And in fact, to be part of the troupe that was performing.
Yeah, and stand 8 or 10 feet away from him. Two Secret Service men moved him out to the freight elevator. Nobody else was there. Danny Kaye and I was there.
Now, in this show for the correspondence, what were you doing? Were you producing that show?
No, I didn't. I delivered Durante and Moore, and I probably went over some of the material.
Oh, I see.
But they wanted me there. CBS put it on, as a matter of fact, because they used to have the card which gave me access. And it was from a fellow used to know at CBS in New York. CBS put it on, but it was not a broadcast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get back to the Durante show for a moment.
Sure.
From start to finish on the Rexall show, the Jimmy Durante show, for example, what did you have to do? Did you have to shepherd all of this from whatever night it was on to the next week, to see that everything, that the writers were on time, and did you approve the script finally, or what?
Oh, yes. Well, the first thing you do is we had a battery of writers, maybe five or six at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You sit down and think what you want to do for next week. Any ideas? Might have a little theme. Then we had a singer on, Georgia Gibbs or Peggy Lee, and Roy Barga was the orchestra director. And you'd work on, you know, what song she was going to sing. So I'd get Roy and Peggy together, the arrangers. Then the writers and I would, or they might come up with an idea for a skit. And then we'd have a monologue for Durante, maybe, or for Gary Moore had it. And Gary would write a lot of his own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, and get help from the writers. So it was a matter of getting pieces and bits together, and that was my job. And then you plan the... Then I had a very good assistant, who's now still with Bob Hope after 30 or something years, who would kind of arrange the physical stuff. You know, we're going to rehearse from so-and-so and call the orchestra and let everybody know and just work it out with the station, NBC or CBS, whoever you were working. And this became a pattern that every Wednesday you would have a rehearsal, and then Thursday, Friday, you'd go and have a dress rehearsal and be on the air at 6 o'clock, which would be 9 o'clock in the East. And then you'd do a repeat show for the coast. So you did two live shows every time you went on from here.
Each with a different studio audience.
Yes.
Were those shows pretty similar? I know you maybe worked in the same script.
But naturally, sometimes that the guys had been out to dinner and had a few drinks. We'd go to the Derby in between or something, which was close by. And you could get a little looser on the second because you were just the West Coast, you see. And the sponsor was back there. So, yeah, there would be a little looseness sometime on the second show. Sometimes too much. And sometimes better. You'd have a chance to improve on somebody with maybe a little bit nervous on the first show in their delivery. They'd be better on the second show.
Would you ever change something that didn't work on the first show?
Sure, I think we did, but not too seriously. But if you could improve something with a change in line or telling somebody what to do, you shouldn't have done that. You would make changes.
Was Jimmy Durante easy to work with on all these
shows?
Very.
For me, it was. We were very, very close.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left Jimmy after his first year in television, it was kind of a traumatic thing for both of us, you know. However, there were the circumstances that made it necessary for me to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jimmy was good to work with. He had his quirk, you know. And my great part of my job was trying to not let Jimmy use material he used in nightclubs, you know, 20 years earlier, which he thought was great. And I was the fresh young kid that was, you know, saw things in the 1940s rather than the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Look.
There was one of those Rexall shows, I know, because I've heard it, where he was kind of reunited with Clayton and Jackson.
Yeah, we did that.
And that was a fun, wonderful show.
Yeah, uh-huh.
They all sound like they had a wonderful time on that.
Broadcast. Well, it was tough for the other fellow, Clayton Jackson and Duane, and Jimmy went on his own, really. Clayton became his manager, so he was with him. And then Eddie Jackson, he would work with Jimmy, but not on the air.
Mm-hmm.
He started, you know, except once in a while, they might use him for a little singing bit. But they did all that. After all, Jimmy did a lot of nightclubs and stuff. Mm-hmm. He'd be working in Las Vegas and places like that.
And Jackson went with him then.
Oh, yes.
For those
yeah.
And came into TV with him.
That's right.
Later then, I think.
Right. And yes, and TV used Eddie every possible time. And he felt at ease there, you know, with Eddie Jackson.
I'm sure that everybody who's ever spoken with you about Jimmy Durante has asked about Mrs. Calabash.
Well, you're talking to the man that first used it.
How did that come about, and what does it mean?
Well, it's been in a book, and it was like everything else, an accidental thing. We were on our way to New York, on the Super Chief, and Jimmy and I were talking, and there used to be a singer named John Charles Thomas back in mm-hmm. the 30s. We used on the radio. Metropolitan opera singer and folk singer and so forth. And he used to say goodnight, Mother. He'd be on Sunday afternoon. And Jimmy thought that was great, you know. It's a nice, nice feeling. So we got into New York, and we were up at CBS till about 12 o'clock at night. Hey, rewriting our script, we were on the air next night. And I said, hey, let's think of something for Jimmy to say. He wants to say goodnight to somebody. So we started going all the way down from Alabaster to Balabanus, you know, back. And I have a calabash pipe in there, I'll show you.
Mm-hmm.
You know what it is, one of those yellow pipes?
Yes, I've seen them. Seen
you know, them. And so, I don't know, it just sounded good. And we all paced up and down, good night, Mrs. Abercrombie. Good night, Mrs. Balaban. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. That sounded pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So we stuck it in just for one night. That's how it started.
And was there any reaction to that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so the agency said, hey, that sounds pretty good. Then later on, he added on, wherever you are. It was that time we just, good night, Mrs. Calabash. Then the mail began to pour in. And, you know, who was Mrs. Calabash? We didn't know what to do with it. It was a gimmick. And you know, I kept a mystery because, you know, why spoil it for Jimmy? And by that time, Jimmy began to believe it, that there was somebody. And people were asking him, and Jimmy was not too fast on his feet, but he said, she was an old girl was coming out of a theater in Louisville. And it was a lady standing there selling papers. And it was my old school teacher from the... And he created these kind of things. And that's who Mrs. Calabash was supposed to be. And of course... It created so much interest, and I had a card printed saying that the Jimmy's name, thank you, but there's some things a gentleman doesn't talk about, and we kind of kept it alive. But it became a beautiful a myth, and we never broke. It wasn't really until Jimmy died that people began to talk about it at all.
It certainly became a significant trademark for him.
And it created a lot of sympathy. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy really believed this himself. He began to think of it as something, you know.
Well, over the years we've heard so many stories. It was an old sweetheart.
That's right. It was
wife.
Jimmy's first wife.
Yeah,
that
right.
was the thing. And then when Lou Clayton died of cancer, they said, Lou Clayton. How he could get to be Mrs. Calabash, I don't know, but there were people that even thought that. Mm-hmm. But it was a thought of Jimmy's, and then when he went on television, he, with the lights on, and he had this trench coat over his shoulder, and he fell. It was a very touching thing, and I respected it. And it wasn't until a fellow named Glenn Taylor, who was at the agency, when he got a book and he wrote about it. Mm-hmm. Although there were some hints. They used to interview me in New York, the guy from the Times, and so when they come out here and ask about that, I'd just say, well, it's one of those things that Jimmy knows about. I don't know. So.
It's showbiz, right?
Yeah, it's but you didn't want to spoil it.
No, don't.
I was the one because of the Calabash. And the guy at the agency sent me a Calabash pipe. I still have it in there. And then I broke Jimmy's heart. This was years later. I'm not no longer working with him, but I'm visiting down in Beverly Hills, Jimmy's house. And he was having someone interviewed from one of the national magazines. And it came up, and they said, well, Jimmy, tell us about Mrs. Calabash. So Jimmy looked, and I walked out of the room. Anyway, I came back, and we talked about it. And I said, well, Jimmy, you know a Calabash? You know what a Calabash? He said, what do you mean? The Calabash is a melon. It's a gourd. And he just couldn't believe it, you know. And I'm sorry that I mentioned it, but... that's what it is. It's a gourd, and they dry them up and make pipes and some other things out of it. But he was a beautiful man, that Jimmy was, and I was hated to see him. He had his strokes, hung on for about 8 or 9 years.
He died in the 70s. Sometime, I think. I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah, about 10 years ago. Yeah. 9 years ago. Yeah. I used to go down and visit him every Friday afternoon and just sit there with him and hear this man who was talk like, you know, loved to talk, that couldn't talk. And
Well, you were very fortunate in that you were able to work with somebody like that.
Oh, I should say so.
Of course, you've had a very interesting career, and... You didn't do too much in television after.
I freelanced. I had a lot of offers from agencies to supervise. Mm-hmm. I supervised the Mickey Rooney show. Then I produced a show with a singer named Guy Mitchell.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. From Max. That was on for about 18 weeks, I think. I produced that. And then when I was back in New York for CBS, there was a 3-network program for the Red Cross, a big hour show. They had. Charles Heston, people like it, a lot of stars. This was a big Red Cross thing by the 3 networks, and I produced it for the 3 networks, and ABC gave us somebody else, a director, and then NBC gave me Meredith Wilson's orchestra. Mm-hmm. All the 3 networks. But the first time was ever done, a 3-network thing, I think. And I did some shows. I did produce a Gary Moore show before his big one back there when I... After I left Durante, I stayed with CBS for about a year. Mm-hmm. And did some TV. And then when I came back here, I worked freelance for a lot of the advertising agencies, NW Air, where I stayed there as sort of a supervisor for the West Coast, television supervisor.
Mm-hmm. Well, you spent a lot of time out here on the West Coast. You've been here permanently
since 1944.
So you've seen many changes.
Over the years.
But it's still a nice place to visit, a place to live, and you look wonderful. You've done it agreed with you, I think.
Yeah, well, I like the outdoor, I like the sea, and I like to play golf and outdoors. I'm from the East. I'm originally from Connecticut.
So you know what you're missing in the wintertime, right?
You're darn right.
And glad of it.
I was down about a year and a half ago in one of those terrific snowstorms. No, I don't miss that at all. I have family back there. I'll be talking to my 94-year-old sister here right after you leave.
Oh, boy.
Back in Meriden, Connecticut. Then I was in New York during the great years, too. The end of the 20s and the 30s.
Well, you were one of the unknown heroes of radio as far as the listening audience is concerned. Because for the most part, the listening audience really wasn't aware of a producer or a director.
We didn't even get credit.
Well, you did get credit on the Durante Show because would hear directed by Phil Cohan.
Yeah.
And that was unusual. And I wonder how that happened.
I was one of the... we formed a Radio Directors Guild. I was one of the founding group. And we got the first contracts eventually. But we were just looking for recognition, and some people would get their name on it, but it wasn't common at all. I think when I did the Paul Whiteman Show, I don't think I took a credit. And I produced and directed that, and I wrote a lot of it. It was just continuity, and we had singers and people on. It wasn't until a little later that they began to give credits, and the networks got used to it.
Yeah, well, on television, of course, you can spend 2 minutes at the end of the show watching.
Oh, yes.
You know, the guy who goes out for coffee.
That's our union, yeah. Well, when we formed our union, we joined the AFL. I was one of the guys that helped get the first contracts out here from ABC and CBS and NBC. At that time, it became just a commonplace thing for credits. But writers didn't even get credit. Like on the Durante Show, maybe at the end of the season, you know, we felt they deserved some credit. We threw in some names, but on a weekly basis, no. I think it was just my credit.
Was that any special reason for that they didn't get the credit? You didn't want to take the time on the air?
Well, you take Jack Benny, who had maybe 12 writers. That's a lot of time.
Takes all the time.
And then you don't... then. 2 weeks later, there'd be two new writers on there. You see, they weren't as permanently a group. Now, a show like Fibber McGee, they had like Don Quinn did it for years and years and years, and created it, did it.
And he always, it seems like he always got credit, you know.
He should have, yeah.
He always got credit on that.
Carlton Morse.
Yeah.
Mostly in the soap operas and in the script shows where one man created and wrote it, yes. But in variety shows, musicals. No, there were too many contributors, really.
And I suppose that the audience, they didn't want to remind the audience that a show like this had to be written. They thought it was maybe spontaneous informal.
Sure.
Yeah, and Bing Crosby's show, for example. I don't think they ever gave Carol Carroll or Ray Singer or any of those people credit.
That's right.
Because Bing was supposed to be very natural. And
the comedians were all supposed to be. Jack Benny, we created all these things, but of course he didn't.
Right.
Durante
couldn't. Phil Cohan, I thank you very much for spending a little time with us and reminiscing about those good old days. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you.